welcome to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, a Lee Enterprises podcast. I'm Nat Cardona. On this podcast, you'll hear true crime stories as told by journalists from regional newspapers across the country. Our next set of episodes are about the Orangeburg Massacre of 1968. And my guess, you probably never heard of what happened there. Back in 1968, Orangeburg was home to two black colleges, and it had a large black population. However, the majority of the economic and political power was still held by the minority white population. It's February 8th, 1968. Roughly 300 protesters from South Carolina State College and Claflin University stage a non-violent demonstration after a black Vietnam War vet was denied access to a local bowling alley, one of the few segregated facilities left in town. The violence began with police officers beating two female students, and it ended with 28 students injured and three murdered. We'll start with setting up social, political, and economic climate at that time. Joining me on this episode is Dr. William Hine, a former professor of history at South Carolina State University for more than 40 years. He's also a published author and one of the authorities of the 1968 massacre. First things first is tell me a little bit about yourself and who you are.
Well, as you know, my name is William Hine. I taught history at South Carolina State for many years, beginning the year of the Orangeburg Massacre, and retired a few years ago. In the meantime, what had been South Carolina State College became South Carolina State University in the early 1990s. So there's sometimes a little bit of confusion about the label or the correct name of the institution. But I did teach history there and wrote a history of the institution as well that came out a couple of years ago. I grew up in Ohio, and then in 1967 came to South Carolina on what I thought would be a temporary teaching assignment for someone who was on leave that year, and I would teach there a year and then move on. But that person did not come back after that year, so I just stayed a second year, and then I decided that, inasmuch as I didn't have a PhD at the time, that I either ought to get a degree in history or move on to something else. So I went back to graduate school at Kent State in Ohio and stayed there for 3 years, working on a doctorate. And then with no other positions available, returned to South Carolina State in the fall of 1972 and stayed there for the remainder of my academic career and involved, as you might expect, in a variety of projects and enterprises dealing with history and other subjects and campus organizations and the usual litany of things that college faculty members get engaged in.
Sure, sure. And the main thing we're talking about today is obviously the Orangeburg Massacre. South Carolina State has done a remarkable job, whether it be, like you said, faculty or students, in commemorating the event every single year. But the reason we reached out to you is because Lee Enterprises owns Orangeburg Times and Democrat, right? So the idea here is that you'd be able to provide context that is not available through the small amount of articles that were written throughout the years about it. And hopefully provide more context than what a Google search can provide, because you Google this and it is actually pretty disheartening at how few links there are to information about what had happened and who was killed and everything that the fallout, all of that. So ideally, I'd like you to bring me back to, you said you were there in 1967. This happened in the beginning of February of 1968. Can you describe what Orangeburg was like at that time? What's going on in the community? What the demographics are? That kind of thing.
Orangeburg is the county seat of the county that has the same name, Orangeburg County. In terms of size, it's the second largest county in in South Carolina, stretching across the Midlands. In terms of its history, since the early 19th century, Orangeburg has consisted of a population of a black majority, going back to the expansion of slavery in the early 19th century. And the county still has a black majority to the present day. In 1967, Orangeburg, with its black majority, had not a single black office holder in local or state government. The state general assembly was entirely white in 1967-68. The county council, the city council, the sheriff, the chief of police, virtually every public office holder elected or appointed was white at that time. And most of the businesses that were white owned in town employed only white people, except for their janitorial crew. There weren't any black retail clerks at Penny's or at the smaller stores around town. Nevertheless, it has had and continues to have two black colleges. Claflin, a Methodist institution founded during Reconstruction in 1869, and then South Carolina State, founded as the only black public higher education institution in South Carolina, four-year institution founded as a land grant, as a kind of counter to Clemson, which was the white land grant institution that had been founded just a few years prior to that in the early 1890s. So you had this community made up of largely a black population, but it was a white power structure in terms of politics as well as the economy.
Okay. And fair to say that there would be a lot of young black youth as well because of the schools, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. And there was a fairly substantial, with the presence of two institutions, a substantial number of middle class black people who worked in administration or faculty, as well as the public schools that were at the times, for all intents and purposes, they were still segregated. There were still two high schools when I arrived in Orangeburg, the black high school, Wilkinson High School, and the white high school, Orangeburg High School. They did merge a couple of years later into one high school, but that was the situation through the 1960s.
Yeah, and that's the perfect segue there, because in 1964, we officially have the desegregation in the South. But, you know, coming up to 1968, the beginning of February, there's this bowling alley, All Star Lanes, right? And it is, it is owned by Mr. Floyd, who says, no blacks allowed. This is my white only policy, yada, yada. Can you explain the context behind that, like how that could still be? Because some people might not understand, even though officially 1964 is a few years before desegregation. Mm-hmm. But here we are. It's still not that much different, right, in 1968. So please go into that if you wouldn't mind.
Well, Orangeburg still lagged behind, despite the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And the prime example became the bowling alley and the proprietor, Harry Floyd, who had literally built the bowling alley earlier in the 60s, operated as a white-only facility. And it was his contention that he could exclude black people, that the bowling alley was not covered under the 1964 Civil Rights Act because it didn't engage in interstate commerce. Now, that was a matter of legal controversy at the time, but that was his position. In the meantime, there were several other facilities in town that remained white only. There were some local laundromats that were white only. The two drive-in movie theaters that existed on the fringe of town would not admit black people to those drive-in facilities. Most of the medical doctors who were white still maintained separate waiting rooms for white and black patients. The local hospital had not yet accepted Medicare that had been enacted in 1965. So there were a number of issues, most of them revolving around race as well as class, that still divided the community 4 years after the 1964 Civil Rights Act that was supposedly brought in desegregation of public facilities.
Sure, that was quite the lag time, as you mentioned.
We need to take a quick break, so don't go too far.
So speaking of February 5th, 1968, we have the small group of students who go into the bowling alley and things ensue there. Can you talk a little bit about that? That was kind of the precursor to what happened on February 8th, ultimately.
Well, actually, it goes back before that. In fact, you could easily go back several years. As part of the hidden history of Orangeburg and civil rights. I mean, back in 1960, and then in through the early 1960s, there were massive civil rights demonstrations in Orangeburg by students of the two colleges. I mean, hundreds of people were marching in the spring of 1960, and large numbers of them were arrested. And then as the weeks and months passed, rearrested in many cases. And on March 15, 1960, 400 students out of 1,000 roughly who marched that day were arrested and incarcerated, and the fire department hosed them down that chilly March day in 1960, 8 years before the massacre. And there's a whole history of that. I might point out, incidentally, that one of those who was arrested that March day was James Clyburn, now a prominent congressman and spokesman for the Democratic Party in Washington. And so he's very familiar with not only those demonstrations, but up through the massacre. So you had this history of student engagement, student participation, student nonviolent protests in Orangeburg. So when you get to 1967 and 68, you've got this bowling alley just down the street from the campuses. And people, at least some people, wanted to bowl. Certainly, most students really weren't interested in bowling. They came from rural South Carolina. There were no bowling alleys in most of the small towns in South Carolina, but some were interested, like John Stroman, who was from Savannah. He genuinely liked to bowl and wanted to bowl and couldn't get in the bowling alley. And then there was another student, James Davis, who had been in the Air Force for a number of years and came back and started college in Orangeburg. He was in his mid or late 20s, and he wanted to bowl and then was infuriated that he'd served in the Air Force, and went down to the bowling alley, and they wouldn't let him in to bowl. And that was weeks prior to January and February, and there was a initial effort to bowl, and Harry Floyd, the owner, was adamant he was not going to admit black people. So they pulled a kind of slick trick on Floyd one afternoon in January. They got one of the few white students at South Carolina State, a fellow named John Bloker, and they persuaded him to go down by himself and bowl, and he went in and got a lane and told Harry Floyd that several of his friends were coming along any minute. And not long after that, they showed up, but they were black friends, and Floyd threw them all out at that point. And that set the stage then for February 5th, when they come down again. There's a confrontation there. The students are removed from the bowling alley. They show up again the next night, Tuesday, February 6th. There's an even larger number of students and a larger employment of law enforcement officers there. And a couple of students are arrested after a big plate glass window was shattered on that Tuesday night, and also a law enforcement officer had some sort of caustic liquid thrown in his eyes that caused some eye damage, and that leads to the arrest. Several dozen students are in the parking lot outside the bowling alley, and then the police weighed in and began to push students around. A fire truck shows up, and some of the students, the older students from the community, knew about the fire hoses from earlier in the demonstrations. And the situation escalated. It was tense, but it wasn't to the point of any physical contact, aside from the arrests that had occurred. And the city authorities, meeting with a couple of college officials, Pete Butler among them, were able to get the arrested students released with the understanding that everyone would go home. Well, at some point, the local police began to hit students as they retreated, and word got back to the campuses that students were being beaten, especially young women. At that point, then more students rushed downtown, and the situation threatened to get out of hand. It did not. There was some property damage to stores and businesses between the campus and the bowling alley. But there were, aside from the students who were beaten, especially the young ladies, there was no damage. There was no looting. Nothing was taken, but there's several hundred, if not several thousand dollars worth of damage done to plate glass windows and to some automobiles in a new car lot down there. But it seems to me anyway that what really set the students off as much as anything was having their fellow students, especially the younger women, beaten that night. And that galvanized the two campuses and solidified the protests and the anger directed toward law enforcement, as well as the political leaders in the community.
Sure. So that brings us to February 8th of 1968. We have that on-campus protest of, a couple hundreds of students. Would you be able to paint the picture of what the protest was intended to be? Would you be able to speak on that?
Well, there were two nights. The night of the confrontation down at the bowling alley with the fire trucks and the students being beaten, that was that Tuesday night. Then Wednesday night, there was an effort to keep the students on the campus. The college president, Maceo Nance, urged students, don't leave the campus. Furthermore, by that time, National Guardsmen and a large contingent of state highway patrolmen had arrived in Orangeburg, and they weren't going to let them off the campus anyway, fearing that if students were to go back downtown, that they would emulate people who had protested in Watts and in Newark and in Cleveland and in Detroit, the urban riots that occurred in 1965, 66, 67. Now it looked like Orangeburg might be incinerated by these Black power advocates, these Black nationalists, led by this young man who'd been involved in SNCC, named Cleveland Sellers, who'd been in town for several months by then. So they were basically confined to the campus that Wednesday, February 7th. And there were a series of incidents, throwing things out on the highway past the campus. Two young white men drove onto the campus in spite of the fact there was supposed to be a curfew. And that caused a sensation of some sort there. But that was a relatively calm night that set the stage for Thursday, February 8th, 1968, where again, students assembled in front of the campus and protested and threw things at the highway patrolmen that were lined up along the edge of the campus. There with National Guardsmen well behind them across the street, across the railroad tracks, on the other side of the two campuses there. It was dark. It was chilly. It was not a well-lit area by any means. It's hard to know how many students were out there. They kind of came and went over a period of time, 8, 9, 10 o'clock that evening. There were some women students out there. They came and went. A bonfire was started on the little street in front of the campus there. The fire department was called to put out the fire. It was a mixture of sort of a festival along with anger and bitterness directed toward the Highway Patrol, which at the time was all white. They were just in the process of hiring their first two Black Highway Patrol officers in early 1968. So you had a contingent of all white law enforcement officers, well armed, and Black students by 10:30 that night, all male, but they were unarmed except with sticks, stones, and some pretty vile language directed at the Highway Patrolman, and that set the stage for the shooting.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick side note before we get into that. How did the National Guard get involved? Just clarification purposes here.
Well, the governor, Robert McNair, was convinced that he had a seriously dangerous situation in Orangeburg because he was convinced that this young man, Cleveland Sellers, had incited these students, especially that Tuesday night. He'd been in town, as I mentioned, for several months and gotten to know a lot of students. There was an organization on the South Carolina State campus known as BACC, B-A-C-C, the Black Awareness Coordinating Committee. He worked with them. There were probably 30 or 40 students out of 2,000 who belonged to BACC, but Governor McNair was convinced that these campuses, and especially South Carolina State with Cleveland Sellers in town, was a hotbed of Black nationalism, radicalism, and that they were eager to virtually incinerate Orangeburg if they weren't controlled. So he dispatched additional highway patrolmen from around the state, and the local National Guard was called up, and they were available as well. But they were not on the campus or near the campus. Probably the closest National Guardsman was 200 or more yards away. And I might point out that the National Guard had weapons, but they weren't loaded.
Okay.
The Highway Patrol had weapons, mostly shotguns, and they were loaded.
And that's where we'll wrap up things this week. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you don't miss the next episode where Dr. Hine details what happened that February night in 1968. Thanks for listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles. I'll see you soon.